Time for North America and South America's favorite real estate show in Eastern Europe and Malaysia, thinking real estate.
Really?
Well, our friends in England listen.
And England. The British Isles enjoy this show.
Our friends from Yorkshire are actually driving to the island of Majorca.
How do you drive to an island?
You go through the channel, or you take a ferry across the English Channel, and then you have to take a ferry from probably Barcelona or one of the other Spanish towns over to Majorca. It's a long trip, but they can't. It's a long trip.
They don't want to be on a plane?
That's part of it, yeah, but you also have some quarantine issues along the way.
I'll stick to Vandercook Lake.
Yeah, there you go. That's your staycation, right?
You could go to the island on Pleasant Lake.
That's true.
So, how are things with you?
We're here.
All right. Are we coming through all right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right.
So, we've had some interesting things happen in the real estate industry. I was talking to another agent, and he... Before we start talking about what he wanted to talk about, he mentioned a deal that they had where an appraisal was done on a house, and there was a plunger next to the toilet.
Yes.
So the appraiser called out, had to have the seller for having, they needed to do some plumbing inspection to make sure there wasn't a problem with the plumbing.
What?
Yeah, just come on. There's a plunger next to the toilet.
Come on.
I'm not kidding you.
No.
We have one next to ours, but it's just art. It's decoration.
Art deco.
I don't think it's a problem with the house plumbing. I think it's a problem with somebody's plumbing is what it is.
That's insane.
That is insane.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. And we just had one come in. I mean, the appraisal came in $80,000 low. It's just unbelievable. The appraisers, I don't know what's going on. I don't know. The weird market.
Well, $80,000 low is, that's pretty low.
Yeah, it wouldn't be bad if it was a $3 million property, but that's not what it is.
And then there was a house that just appraised north of where you live, Greg, in the city for $199,000. So go figure.
Hey.
Yeah, I think appraisers, and look, I have empathy for appraisers. It's a difficult task to try and keep up with what the market is, particularly with this COVID-19 pandemic. So it's a little unusual, and there are limitations as a result of the real estate crash in 2008. There are limitations on how much an appraiser can do and what you can try to do in terms of getting the appraisal corrected. So this is not an easy task.
But, well, how, Bill, help me out. How would COVID affect an appraisal?
Because the appraiser has to take into account what the market conditions are. And when you look, the appraiser, what are they limited to? The last 6 months?
The last 6 months. However, I would think that because real estate industry was closed down for 2 months, that underwriting would take that into consider and allow the appraiser to go back further than just 6 months just to get comparables.
But the problem is trying to get comps in a market that was essentially closed for 2 months. That's part of the issue. So as an appraiser, you're sitting there fumbling trying to figure out, okay, what is going on here? But in Laura's instance of an $80,000 deficiency in the appraisal, the market is, it's pretty borne out that the price of this particular property is what the market price is. So it's just a screwy market, except
in this situation, other houses in the area have been selling for the same price, and this house had a purchase agreement that came in over the sale price and two at full price, and for the appraiser to come in at what they did is just it doesn't make any sense at all. So.
So anyway, that's one issue. But I actually, before we started down that path, I wanted to mention last week we talked about the moratorium expiring with respect to evictions of tenants. Since we talked last Monday, the governor has extended that moratorium until July 15. So the earliest that a landlord can start an eviction for non-payment of rent is now July 16.
Right.
So that's been extended. So I wanted to just bring the update here.
Mm-hmm. It'll probably, don't you think, with the outbreak and COVID, it'll be extended again?
I don't know. I don't know what landlords. We're fortunate as landlords. We've only got, one tenant that hasn't.
They moved out. So I've got two really cute apartments available. Super cute.
But, there are a lot of landlords who are having difficulty making mortgage payments, utility payments, soon to be tax payments, July 1. So it's difficult. And, I always encourage tenants who are struggling to contact the landlord to work out some accommodation, to get some payment so that the landlord isn't strapped as a result.
There's so many programs out there to assist tenants with paying their rent right now.
Well, and there's the not only the state unemployment, there's a $600 a week bump that's provided by the federal government under the CARES Act. So, the other thing is tenants need to realize that the rent is not forgiven. You still have to pay rent for that period of time. So you're better off working with the landlord to minimize what that accrued balance is going to be and to work out a payment plan to get it paid back so that you don't get evicted come July 16th.
Well, I wanted to talk about variances.
Before we do it, Greg, anything else we ought to talk about with respect to this moratorium and with respect to rental evictions, or should we move on to this issue Laura wants to talk about, which is variances?
Yeah, we can move on.
All right.
All right. So I have a client that is going for a use variance. It's the zoning of the property is a C1, which means that you could do pretty much any retail you want there. The property is a house and was at one time used as a law firm. Most recently was just a display for art. And now this person wants to use it for adult foster care and live on the second floor. Although with the C1 zoning, you can live on the second floor. What's the process for going through a variance?
You asking me or you asking Greg?
Well, I'm going to ask you because you're the attorney. And I'm sure Greg knows the answer, but he would rather hear it from you. Right, Greg?
I'll agree with what Bill says.
Yeah, there are two kinds of variances. There's a non-use variance, sometimes referred to as a dimension variance or an area variance. It's a variance, typically, that kind of variance, it's with respect to setbacks. And a good example is our cottage in Tawa City. We're located along Business US 23. And the setback when the house was built back in probably the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was set closer to the road, and then the right-of-way expanded. And so now we are grandfathered into the current setback. Well, we're talking about doing an addition, but because of the lot being squeezed in between the road and the lake, we will end up applying for a variance from the setback. And the standard there is less than a use variance. The other type of variance is a use variance, which is what Laura was talking about. And a dimension variance or a non-use variance, you simply have to show that there are, quote, practical difficulties, end quote, in satisfying the requirements of the ordinance. For example, if a setback from the front road is 25 feet, but there's a practical difficulty in actually meeting that because of the size of the lot between the road and the lake, then you apply to, it's the Zoning Board of Appeals that has the authority under the statute to grant a variance. And a non-use variance is easier to get than a use variance. The standard is much stricter. So for a non-use variance, you have to find a practical difficulty in actually satisfying the existing, in this case, setback. And then the ZBA also has to determine whether that whether or not compliance with the current restriction would unreasonably prevent the owner from using the property for a permitted purpose, or would render conformity with a restriction unnecessarily burdensome. That's a little technical, but essentially you have to show that by enforcing the ordinance, in this case a setback against the property owner, you're not allowing the owner to reasonably use the property for the permitted purpose under the zoning ordinance. So that's one of the other standards. Now, a third standard is whether the grant of the variance would do, quote, substantial justice to the applicant for the variance, as well as the other property owners. In other words, if the variance that we seek for changing the setback or being able to do less setback, as long as that doesn't adversely affect or unreasonably adversely affect the other property owners, which it wouldn't, because there are other cottages and houses along here that also have the same violation of the current setback requirement. So you look at whether or not it would do substantial justice to the applicant and also to the adjoining properties. And then the final standard for a non-use variance is whether the variance can be granted in such a fashion that the spirit of the ordinance will be observed and public safety and welfare is secured as well. So those are the things that the ZBA looks at in a non-use variance. The non-use variances are much easier to get. That's not necessarily that you're assured to get a non-use variance, but they're easier to get than a use variance. And there's a process you go through in terms of the application and then the hearing, notification to the adjoining property owners or nearby property owners. And then just proceeding to show that, in fact, you can satisfy those standards. Use variance, though, that Laura's going for is a much more stringent standard. As the ZBA there, in order to grant a use variance, in other words, a use that's not permitted under the zoning ordinance, either as a permitted use or as a special or conditional use, you have to show that there's, quote, unnecessary hardship. Okay? And that is the factors there are, and there are four of them. First, that the property cannot reasonably be used for the purposes permitted in the zoning district. That's sort of a given. Okay, I can't use it. Now, you know, in Laura's case, we're sitting here talking about whether or not this property is suitable for some other use in the zoning district, and she can talk about that in a second. Two, that the circumstances giving rise to the variance request are unique to the property and not general conditions of the neighborhood itself. In other words, you have to show that, hey, this property now under the zoning is not suitable for that particular permitted use within the zoning ordinance, but the rest of the neighborhood is still within the zoning ordinance. It's still being used for the purposes permitted under the zoning ordinance. Three, that the use authorized by the variance will not alter the essential character of the area. Again, I can't come in and, if I'm not zoned for, let's say, a marijuana dispensary, the zoning doesn't permit it, and I want to put a marijuana dispensary there in this property, that's going to be out of character for the rest of the area. It's not going to be you're not going to get a use variance with respect to that kind of use. There's no unnecessary hardship, and it's going to change the character of the area. And then four, that the applicant's problem is not self-created. That's a real issue in terms of getting a use variance, because very often somebody comes in and they want to buy a property, and they have a different use for it. Well, if they buy the property thinking they're going to get a use variance, they're barking up the wrong tree, because they created that problem themselves. This is where the owner of the property before the sale should actually apply for the variance, saying, hey, I'm unable to sell this property, or I'm unable to use this property, I'm unable to rent this property because of the restrictions under the current.
But the application allows either the seller, the buyer, or a potential tenant to apply for the use variance.
You can, but you do have to have the consent of the owner. You're not going to be able to get it without. And I always say that it's easy. You have to do it before the sale, though. And you have to do it before the lease. Because if you enter into those and you're the purchaser of the property, you just created your own problem. You could have gone elsewhere for this particular property or for this particular use in a different property. But in Laura's case, you want to explain exactly what's going on with that one?
Well, my purchaser is putting in an adult foster care home in a C1 zoning, which is right on the edge of residential property. It's a perfect spot for her for this use also, and because of the building itself. And to use that building for retail would be difficult because it doesn't have the parking, it has threshold intimidation. Anytime you take a house and make it into retail, you've got threshold intimidation.
What's threshold intimidation? You mean it's step-up or something?
No, it's people hesitate to go in because they don't feel comfortable walking through the door of a house, or maybe it's a downtown building, and the Dupuis building had a threshold intimidation and had this beautiful, still has it, nobody's done anything with it, has this beautiful door, and people would feel intimidated going through it because they didn't know what was on the other side or felt they would get pressured, and not that Dupuis ever did that, but it's just the door itself. It's just called threshold intimidation.
So are you going to apply for a variance on this particular?
Yeah, we're already doing that. And since Jackie has an urban planning degree, she's helping the applicant answer those four questions that you just, well, those weren't questions, they were more statements, but we have to address all four issues in the application. And then they send it out to all the neighbors, right? The 300 feet?
Yeah, I believe it's anybody within 300 feet gets notification of the variance application. But the smartest thing you can do, too, in applying for variance is go talk with the municipality beforehand. Say, hey, look, here's what I am proposing. What do you think about it? Do I stand a reasonable chance? Now, the staff or personnel within the municipality can't assure you that you're going to get a variance.
Which is exactly what's happened. And we have talked to the city. And
who can block that, Bill?
Well, neighbors can show up if they're opposed to it. They're entitled to come to the public hearing or to submit something in writing to say, hey, look, we oppose the particular proposed, we oppose the proposed non-use variance or the proposed use variance, and then show why, in fact, the standards that I just recited a few minutes ago are not met for either type of variance. And the ZBA itself is required by statute and by the court decisions to make specific findings on the record that all of the conditions required for the variance are satisfied. So it's a process, and my experience with ZBAs is they're very good at, you know, they listen to the staff.
Right.
And then they will conduct a hearing and determine whether or not those standards are met. And there's a give and take. You know, the applicant gets the opportunity to do a presentation. They mm-hmm. get to ask the applicant and the applicant's consultants whether or not the...
Well, and you also look to proposed future land use. So is the area changing? What does the master plan call for? It's an interesting process.
Yeah, master plans are usually more in terms of rezoning applications as opposed to variance requests, because the master plan doesn't really address the variance.
So why go for a variance versus a rezoning?
Because rezoning is more difficult, and you can't rezone a particular property because that's spot zoning. You can't rezone a particular property out of character with the other properties in the neighborhood. So and rezoning is a much more complicated process.
And this is interesting because it's a house. Next door to it is a house that is a commercial property used for retail. And then next door to that is a residential neighborhood. And adult foster care homes 6 and under are put in residential neighborhoods. So I think that's, right. I mean, I think there's a good chance simply because of the dynamics of the neighborhood itself.
Well, Bill, we only have a minute or so, but if you... Say you had 10 neighbors and only one opposed, that wouldn't make any difference, you know, those numbers at all?
Yeah. Now, let's suppose I've got 10 neighbors that are all affected, and 9 of them show up or they send a letter of support, which is a good thing for the applicant to have, get letters of support from neighbors. The fact that one neighbor opposes it, he can't simply stand, or he or she can't stand up and say, well, I oppose it. They have to provide the rationale as to why the particular standards have not been met. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's not simply the opposition. It's have these standards been met.
So, Laura, are you selling anything here?
Well, I would like to sell more. I've got 214 Pierce is a three-bedroom, one-bath home with a first-floor bedroom, by the way, a nice fenced and backyard, a one-car garage that's just been painted. Nice pavement in front of the property, just got repaved a few weeks ago, in Summit Township for $79.9. Good deal. And it's move-in ready. Also, we've got some commercial properties ranging from $110,000 up to $569.9. Good size property down to just a corner, a building on a corner lot, and a lot of different uses. So call me on those. And then I have a couple of apartments available. Both are two bedrooms. Both are second floor units. One has laundry in it. And I don't know what the rent is, but if somebody's looking, they can get a hold of me. And I would love to talk to some buyers and sellers and get some properties on the market and get them sold for them. So call me, Laura Schlechte, 780-3800.